morning. My name is Sissy. I'm one of the pastors here, and I'm so glad that you've joined us this morning. We are in the middle of a series that we've entitled Unexpected Jesus, where we have together been exploring some of the miracles of Jesus. And Barry kicked us off last week, and he taught us that the miracles of Jesus reveal something about the way Jesus sees the world, the way Jesus wants the world to be, and the way that he will one day make the world. And we took a look last week at Jesus turning water into wine at the wedding in Cana. And this morning, we're going to look at yet another miracle of Jesus to discover, or perhaps rediscover, who Jesus really is. And as I thought about that, I was reminded of what my life was like before I truly discovered who Jesus is. I grew up in a Christian home. My parents loved Jesus. They tried to teach me to love Jesus. But because of significant trauma that I experienced as a child, I just never felt loved. I never felt good enough. And so I tried to find my value, my worth, my identity in the love and approval of others. And initially it was my parents. And so there's two things you need to know about my parents. One, I've already told you that they love Jesus. The second thing you need to know is that they're Indian immigrants. And so they came to this country some 47 years ago to give my sister, my brother, and myself a better life. And so there were two things that they wanted for me. They wanted me to love Jesus, and they wanted me to do well in school because they believed education was the key to success. And so I went after those two things hard. I was awesome at church. I don't really know how you could be awesome at church because it's not like it's a sport or a hobby, but I was awesome. I was in church all the time. I was in youth group. I led youth group. I knew the Bible. I memorized large chunks of the Bible. You name it, I did it, and I rocked it. I was legendary. And I did fairly well at school. And then as time went on, I began to seek my value, my worth, through the love and approval of friends and in relationships. But no matter what anyone did, no matter what anyone said, they couldn't give me what my heart so desperately longed for. I struggled with anger, rage, an incredible lack of self-control, anxiety, and fear. I spent every minute of my life being afraid. I didn't know there was another way to live. I trusted no one. I always had this wall of, I would only let people get so close because I was so afraid of being hurt. It's an incredibly lonely way to live and not at all how we were meant to be. I tried to pretend like everything was okay, but by my senior year of college, I just couldn't pretend anymore. I couldn't ignore it anymore. On the outside, my life looked perfect. I had landed the dream job that everyone wanted. I was dating the right guy. I was well-liked, had lots of friends. But inside, I was dead. I was miserable. I felt so alone, so lost, so confused. And I remember thinking, if this is all there is to life, then life just doesn't seem worth living. And it wasn't an emotional thought. It was just really logical. Life just doesn't seem worth living. Because no matter what I did, no matter what anyone else did, I couldn't fix what was broken inside of me. And it felt like I was drowning in my own brokenness, like I was just gasping for air. My life was a complete and total mess. And at some point in our lives, many of us, if not all of us, have felt that way, haven't we? Maybe you feel that way right now. Maybe you feel lost and alone, confused. No one to save you, no one to rescue you, no one to fix all that's broken inside of you and what's broken around you. Perhaps you feel like your world is spinning out of control and you have no idea what to do. Your mind and your soul are filled with such chaos, such confusion that it feels like you're drowning, like you can't even breathe. Here's what I want you to hear me say this morning and what I pray would sink into the deepest parts of your soul. There's hope in Jesus. Hope isn't wishful thinking or a nice idea. Hope is a person and his name is Jesus. And so this morning, what I want to do is for us to take a look at this miracle of Jesus found in Luke 8, 26 to 39. So if you have your Bibles, please turn there with me, Luke 8, 26 to 39 is where we'll be. It's the story of Jesus and the demon-possessed man. And as we look at this scene, here's what I want to show us. Jesus rules over our chaos and renews us with peace. Jesus rules over our chaos and renews us with peace. And so what I want to do is just simply to walk through this scene with you and to share with you three observations about Jesus. And then I'm going to close by leaving us with the question to help us reflect upon our own lives. Now, as you read through the scriptures, particularly as you read through the gospels, these historical accounts of Jesus' life, it's important to pay attention to what the writers tell us and even the order in which they tell us these stories. And so right before this scene that we're going to look at, Luke tells us that Jesus and his disciples are on a boat. And suddenly they find themselves in the middle of a raging storm. The water is choppy, the waves are overwhelming, and Jesus has fallen asleep. And this is one of the things that I love about Jesus. He's both God and man. And as a man, he gets tired, and so he falls asleep. Jesus knows what it's like to be tired, so tired that you could sleep through a storm. But they're in serious danger here, and so the disciples are freaking out. Many of them are professional fishermen. They've been in storms before. They know how to handle themselves in bad weather. But this storm is different. It's fierce. It's dangerous. And so they're scared. And so they wake Jesus, and Jesus gets up, and he rebukes the wind and the waves, and the storm subsides. And the disciples are amazed. Who is this that even the wind and the waves obey him? You see, the disciples are also in the process of discovering who Jesus is. By the word of his mouth, Jesus commands creation, and it obeys him. Now, I want you to hold on to that scene, because we're going to come back to it in a little bit. But for now, let's jump into the story of Jesus and the demon-possessed man. And I just want to point out that last week, Barry got to talk about wine, and this week, I get to talk about demons. So I feel like I got the short end of the stick. But there's much to learn about Jesus from this scene, so let's jump in. Luke 8, picking up at verse 26. They sailed to the region of the Gerasenes, which is across the lake from Galilee. When Jesus stepped ashore, he was met by a demon-possessed man from the town. For a long time, this man had not worn clothes or lived in a house, but he had lived in the tombs. And when he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell at his feet, shouting at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, don't torture me." For Jesus had commanded the impure spirit to come out of the man. And many times it had seized him, and though he was chained hand and foot and kept under guard, he had broken his chains and had been driven by the demon into solitary places. Jesus and his disciples sailed to the region of the Gerasenes. And this is the first time Jesus, a Jewish rabbi, has crossed over into predominantly Gentile area. Jesus crosses cultural and ethnic barriers that would have been unheard of in his day. Jews would never associate with Gentiles. No good Jew would do this, certainly not a rabbi. And once he gets there, he's met by this demon-possessed man. Okay, so let's talk demon possession. And I know that when you came into church this morning, this is the kind of stuff that you wanted to hear about. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, because the demons aren't the point of the story. Jesus is the point of the story. And so we're going to spend our time looking at Jesus. But here's what I want to say about demons. The devil and demons are real. Jesus was the smartest man that ever lived, and he believed in demons. Just because we don't understand something in scripture or it makes us uncomfortable doesn't mean it's untrue. And if the smartest man that ever lived, who also happens to be the Son of God, believed it, then I'm going to believe it too. Jesus believed it, and so we should believe it. But what exactly do we do with demons? I think when it comes to something like this, we have to hold two things in tension. One thing we can't do is to think that there's a demon behind every illness, particularly mental illness. We live in a fallen world as a result of sin. And so illness and disease is part of that. And mental illness is a real disease, just like any other disease. And those that suffer from mental illness ought to be treated with dignity and respect. And so one extreme would say that there's a demon lurking behind every corner, and so that's why I'm sick, or the devil made me do it, that's why I sin. That would be wrong. But it would be equally wrong to think that demons don't exist or aren't real. So we have to hold both of these things in tension. But as we walk through this scene, again, the demons aren't the point of the story. And so we would do well to focus on Jesus and how he has compassion on this man, how he treats this man. And so Jesus is met by the demon-possessed man. Now, we don't know his name, but we do know some things about him. He has a long history of living in isolation. Luke tells us that he doesn't live in a house, but that he lives among the tombs. And in this culture, tombs were often built into the hillside outside of the city limits. And so you can sense the darkness here. This man lives among the dead. And Luke goes on to tell us that he's uncontrollable. He was chained hand and foot. He's guarded like he's a wild animal. He's not even treated like a human being because he's a danger to himself and to society. And the demon is so powerful that he's able to break the chains. No one is strong enough to subdue this man. No one could control him. No one could help him. Mark also records this very same story in his gospel, and he gives us a few other details. Mark tells us that night and day, this man lived among the tombs in the hills, and he would cry out, and he would cut himself with stones. This man is alone, out of control, and naked. He's in such pain, such anguish, that he goes around screaming and cutting himself. This is a desperate man. And Jesus commands the demons to come out of him. And so he cries out and he falls at Jesus' feet shouting, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, don't torture me." The demon recognizes who Jesus is. He knows he's the Son of God. And so the demon-possessed man falls before Jesus because he recognizes Jesus' power and authority. The demons know that Jesus is superior and that they are inferior. They know who's in charge here, and it's not them. They were the ones torturing this man, and they begged Jesus not to torture them. Do you see the irony here? Let's get back to the story, verse 30. Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "Legion," he replied, because many demons had gone into him. And they begged Jesus repeatedly not to order them to go into the abyss. A large herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside, and the demons begged Jesus to let them go into the pigs, and he gave them permission. And when the demons came out of the man, they went into the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and was drowned. When those tending the pigs saw what had happened, they ran off and reported this in the town and countryside. And the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they found the man from whom the demons had gone out sitting at Jesus' feet, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it told the people how the demon-possessed man had been cured. Then all the people of the region of the Gerasenes asked Jesus to leave them because they were overcome with fear. And so he got into the boat and left. Jesus asked the demon what his name is, and he replies, "Legion," because there were so many of them. A legion is a military unit made up of 5,000 soldiers. And so the name Legion tells us that this man was possessed by multiple demons. And by using this military term, you get the sense that there's almost a war being waged here, a war for this man's soul. And Jesus is outnumbered, but he's not outmatched. He commands the demons to come out of this man. Jesus is the Son of God, and the demons know it, and so they beg him to not send them into the abyss, but rather to send them into the pigs. The abyss was believed to be the place where demons were punished, so of course that's not where they want to go. And Jesus grants them permission. You don't ask permission from someone who is inferior to you. The demons need Jesus' permission because they recognize that he is superior and that they are inferior. They come out of this man, they go into the pigs, who then drown in the lake. Now, this isn't something you see happen every day. It's not a typical day in the life of a pig herder. Although I'm from New Jersey, so I'm not really sure in the life of a pig herder would be, but it's certainly not this. And so the pig herders run off and they go into town and they tell everyone in town what happened. And now the townspeople come to see what's going on. And when they get there, they find this formerly demon-possessed man sitting at Jesus' feet, dressed and in his right mind. And they're overcome with fear and they ask Jesus to leave. Now, we're not told specifically why they're afraid, but I think they see what happens and they just don't know what to do with it. They don't know what to do with Jesus. Jesus commands the demons to come out of this man and into the pigs. And Mark tells us that 2,000 pigs drowned that day. That's a lot of bacon to not bring home. And so they're likely afraid because of the economic loss that they've suffered. They don't want Jesus to cost them anything else. But Jesus is far more concerned with this man's life than financial gain. You see, a complete reversal has taken place in this man's life. He's sitting at Jesus' feet. Sitting at the feet of that, that's a technical phrase in the ancient world for being a disciple. This man is sitting at Jesus' feet. He's a disciple of Jesus. He had been alone and isolated, and now he's a disciple. Now he belongs. He had been naked, and now he's fully clothed. His dignity has been restored. He'd been completely out of control, and now he's in his right mind. The people see this, and they reject Jesus in fear. But let's take a look at how this man responds. Verse 38. The man from whom the demons had gone out begged to go with him. But Jesus sent him away saying, "Return home and tell how much God has done for you." So the man went away and told all over town how much Jesus had done for him. The man begs to go with Jesus, but Jesus tells him to return to his home. Jesus restores him to his community and he gives him a commission. Go and tell how much God has done for you. And that's exactly what he does. He goes all over town and he shares what Jesus has done for him. And the word used here in the Greek to describe how this man shared about Jesus can be translated to preach or to proclaim. This man preached. And with a story like his, I'm sure that people listened. So let me share with you three observations about Jesus. Here's the first one. Jesus rules with compassionate power over the chaos of our lives. What we see in this scene is that Jesus has authority and power over our chaos. I want you to think back to that scene when Jesus and his disciples were in the boat in the middle of that raging storm. In the ancient world, the sea was seen as a metaphor for disorder and chaos. But here we see that Jesus has power over external chaos. He simply speaks and the wind and the waves obey him. And now in the scene with this man, we see that Jesus rules with compassionate power over our internal chaos. Jesus, a Jewish rabbi, goes to a Gentile region. He crosses ethnic, social, cultural barriers to go to this man. No good Jew would do this. No rabbi would do this. No rabbi, that is, but Jesus. Jesus is so filled with compassion. He goes to this man, a man nobody knows what to do with, a man who's been tossed aside by society. And he's oppressed by these demons. But as soon as he meets Jesus, the demons recognize Jesus for who he is. What do you want with us, Jesus? Don't torture us. Jesus is superior to these demons, and they know it. They may be greater in number, but he's greater in power. And so they ask Jesus' permission to go into the pigs. Jesus is in charge. Jesus is in control, and he will never allow evil to prevail over this man's life. Jesus sees the oppression, the bondage that this man is under because of these demons, and he goes to him and he rules with compassionate power over the chaos of his life. And friends, Jesus rules over the chaos that's wreaking havoc in your life as well. Whether it's chaos because of a debilitating sickness, a broken relationship, job loss, or the unbearable grief from the loss of someone you love, Jesus rules over it. He sees you, he loves you, he has not forgotten you, and he is both all-loving and all-powerful. I'm not saying follow Jesus and your life will be perfect, because I can guarantee you it won't. But I am saying that Jesus is both compassionate and powerful, and he will see you through the darkest of times, because that's the kind of God that he is. You know, when I think of chaos and confusion, there's a distinct memory that comes to my mind from 18 years ago. 18 years ago on September 11th, I was in New York City. I was a grad student at New York University, which is located just less than 10 blocks from the World Trade Center. And I remember that morning just being this beautiful morning. And so the streets were overflowing with people. It was just a little bit busier than a normal Tuesday morning in downtown New York. And then the towers were hit. And the streets were filled with chaos. People were running everywhere. No one knew what to do or where to go. And the towers began to collapse and buildings around it began to crumble as well. Smoke and debris was everywhere. Black soot and ash covered, blanketed the streets, the cars, the people. And we watched as men and women jumped out of burning buildings, hundreds of feet to their death. New York City looked like a war zone. And in the aftermath, no one knew what would happen next. Would there be another attack? Were we even safe? What had happened to our city, to our world? The fear was almost debilitating. A black cloud of smoke and a horrible stench from the burning buildings hung in the air. But in the Sunday that followed those attacks, Sunday, September 16th, the churches all over New York City were filled to capacity with distraught New Yorkers. You see, in a city known for its skeptics, even for its cynics, when overwhelmed by the chaos and confusion of life, people recognize that Jesus rules over our chaos and renews us with peace. And so in the days and weeks that followed the attacks, many New Yorkers came to put their faith in Jesus. Jesus rules with compassionate power over the chaos of our lives. Here's observation two. Jesus renews us with peace. Jesus doesn't just rule, he renews us with peace. This man was alone and living among the dead. He's a social outcast. He's not even treated like a human being. He's bound with chains like he's a wild animal because they don't know what to do with him. He's naked and stripped of his dignity. He's out of control, and he goes around screaming and cutting himself. His life is in complete and utter turmoil. But then he meets Jesus, and Jesus rules over his chaos and renews him with peace. After Jesus commands the demons to come out of him, we find him sitting at Jesus' feet. The one who was a despised outcast is now a devoted follower. We find him clothed. The one who was once covered in shame is now dressed with dignity. We find him in his right mind. The one who was once in ruin is now renewed with peace. This is what Jesus does for this man. This is what Jesus did for me. I remember sitting in my room my senior year of college and just thinking, God, I know you're real. I just don't know if you love me or if you even like me. But something in me made me question how I was living because it just wasn't working. And so I began to look at people around me, people that were influential in my life, like my parents and my grandparents. And for them, they just had this real relationship with Jesus. Their relationship with Jesus made a difference in their lives. And so I thought, either they're foolish, they're crazy, or they're right. And I knew they weren't foolish. I knew they were fairly intelligent people. But legit, they could be crazy. This whole thing could be made up. Or they could be right. How do I figure this out? And I prayed what I believe is probably the first honest prayer of my life. And I just said, God, I know you're real. And you say you reveal yourself in these scriptures. And so if that's true, God, if you love me, then please show yourself to me. And I began to read my Bible in a way I never had before. I knew the Bible. I'd memorized large portions of the Bible. But this time it was different. And I wish I had adequate words to describe to you what happened. But all I could tell you is that God showed up. And I found him to be beautiful. And I had this overwhelming sense that what the scriptures say is true. Not true in some factual way, but true for me, true for my life. And I finally understood that Jesus ruled over my chaos and he could renew me with peace. That Jesus ruled over all of my brokenness, all of my sin, all of my shame. Jesus ruled with compassion and power and he renewed me with peace. No one else could do that. No one else could fix what was broken inside of me. But that's what Jesus did. That's what he continues to do for me. He gave me a new identity. I am loved, accepted, forgiven, and free. He calls me his disciple. Today, I walk in more freedom and more joy than I ever thought could be possible. I never thought my life could be like this. I have seen Jesus heal me, bind up my wounds, restore and renew me in ways that I would have never imagined. That's what Jesus does. And friends, it's not just me. He wants to do that for each one of you. No matter who you are, no matter what you've done, no matter what's been done to you, whether you are a man or a woman, whether you are young or old, whether you are an immigrant or a citizen, whether you are rich or poor, whether you are educated or uneducated, whether you are single or married, Jesus rules over your chaos and he wants to renew you with peace. He offers you a new identity. He invites you to be his disciple. The invitation of Jesus is to be with him so as to become like him and then to carry on his work in the world. This is what Jesus invites you into, and so many of us are searching for something that Jesus longs to give us, that he freely offers us. Jesus says, come to me, put your trust in me, follow me. Why would we ever miss that invitation? Why would we ever miss that invitation? That leads us to our third and final observation. Jesus requires a response. An encounter with Jesus requires a response. There are two different responses to Jesus in the scene. The townspeople responded in fear. They're afraid because Jesus has come and he's turned everything upside down and it's cost them something. They reject him because they're worried about what else he might do, what else he might mess up, and what else it might cost them. Jesus has a way of taking us out of our comfort zones, doesn't he? And these people are more concerned with their comfort than in following Jesus. They come face to face with the evidence of Jesus' compassion and power through the transformed life of this man, and they find it easier to reject him than to trust him. But this man whose life has been forever changed has a very different response. In Mark's account of the scene, at the very beginning, when Jesus gets to this region, Mark says that this man sees him from far off and he ran to him. And the text doesn't tell us this, but I think it's because he realizes who Jesus is and he knows that Jesus is his only hope. Jesus is the only one who can save him. And so he runs to him. And at the end of this scene, when the townspeople reject Jesus and they ask him to leave, this man wants to go with him. He comes face to face with the compassion and power of Jesus and he becomes a devoted follower, a disciple, and he wants to go where Jesus goes. And Jesus gives him a commission. He wants him to carry on his work right where he is. And so he commissions him to return home and to go and tell how much God has done for him. This man is, in effect, the first apostle to the Gentiles. He didn't need a platform, a stage, a podcast, or a YouTube channel. His community knows him. They know what his life was like before he met Jesus. They see what his life is like now. There's no one better than him to share the good news of Jesus. And so he goes back to his community and he proclaims all that Jesus has done for him. And a story like his, that's a story that'll preach. Here's the thing. If you become a disciple of Jesus, if you become a devoted follower, then Jesus will turn your life upside down. He will take you out of your comfort zones. Following Jesus will likely cost you something. But what you receive in return, abundant life, deep joy, indescribable peace, that's worth more than you can imagine. Because Jesus is all powerful, it means that he rules over our chaos. But it also means that he's worthy of our lives. He's worthy of our trust. Because not only is he all powerful, but he's all loving. He comes after us. He pursues us. The God of the universe came for you. No matter who you are, no matter how bad you think things are, no matter how much chaos and confusion is taking place in your life, Jesus rules over our chaos and he renews us with peace. He offers you a new identity. He calls you a disciple. And God's desire for your life is to make you more like Jesus. And the more you become like Jesus, the more you become the person he's always intended you to be, the more you become like Jesus, the more you become your true self. This is what Jesus is after. This is what Jesus wants for you. Jesus cares deeply about who you're becoming. And not only does he want to transform you, but he wants to use you to transform the world around you. So here's the question for us this morning. How will you respond? How will you respond? Will you respond like this man and trust Jesus? Or will you respond like the townspeople and reject Jesus? Some of you are here this morning and you've never put your trust in Jesus, and that's exactly what he invites you to do. Jesus rules over our chaos and he renews us with peace. But will you accept the invitation? Will you trust him or will you reject him? Will you run to him or will you run from him? Will you draw near to him or will you distance yourself from him? An encounter with Jesus requires a response. Others of you are sitting here and you're already a disciple of Jesus. But there are places of chaos and confusion in your life, devastating practices and patterns that you need to bring to Jesus. You think you have it under control, but you don't. You know, at the lowest point of my life, on the outside, everything looked great. No one ever knew how bad it was, how overwhelmed by chaos and confusion I was. And maybe you're like me. Maybe on the outside, things look great, but inside, you are filled with turmoil. Jesus rules over your chaos, and he wants to renew you with peace. But will you accept the invitation? Will you trust him or will you reject him? Will you run to him or will you run from him? Will you draw near to him or will you distance yourself from him? An encounter with Jesus requires a response. And for all of us who call ourselves followers of Jesus, Jesus commissions us to proclaim the truth of what God has done in our lives when we share our stories. So who do you need to share your story with? Your story matters. Your story can make a difference in the lives of others. And so I want to encourage you this week to pray for opportunities to share your story of what God has done in your life with one other person. The most impactful faith conversations I've had have not been when I've argued about theological doctrines and issues. It's just not been my experience. The most impactful faith conversations I've had have been when I've simply said, let me tell you what my life was like before I met Jesus. Let me tell you what my life is like now. That's powerful. That's what people need to hear. Your story matters. You have a story, and only you can share that story. And we proclaim the truth of who God is every time we share our stories. In this scene, we see who Jesus really is. He's a God who comes for those who are desperate, alone, and lost. He's a God who comes for those who rebel against him, who want nothing to do with him. He's a God who's loving and compassionate, who gave his very life to free us from sin, shame, and every kind of evil. He's a God who's coming again to set all things right. That's the kind of God I believe in. That's the kind of God I can give my life to. That's who Jesus is. Jesus rules over our chaos and renews us with peace. It seems only fitting, it seems only right that we respond this morning by coming to the table to remember and to celebrate a God who rules over our chaos and by his very life renews us with peace. At this table, what we remember, what we celebrate is that Jesus gave his life to be our peace. He did that for you and he did that for me. If you're here this morning and for whatever reason you can't navigate the steps, just slip up your hand and one of our ushers will come and serve you the elements right where you are. As you come to the front, you may want to come here and kneel and pray, perhaps light an amber candle as a symbol of a prayer that you're offering to God. Perhaps this morning, what you need to pray is to ask Jesus to rule over your chaos and to renew you with peace. Perhaps it's a prayer of confession and repentance because for far too long, you've been trying to do it on your own. You think you have it under control, but you don't. You need to bring those places of chaos and confusion, those devastating and destructive patterns and practices to the feet of Jesus, and you need to ask him to rule over your chaos and renew you with peace. He loves to answer those kind of prayers. For others of you, you're sitting here and you've never put your trust in Jesus. Look right at me. This moment is for you. Perhaps you feel like a despised outcast. Jesus invites you to become a devoted follower. He came for you. He pursues you. He's a God you can trust. So if that's you this morning, you can talk to God right where you are, but you're also welcome to come here to the front and to light a red candle as a symbol of your newfound relationship with Jesus. And as always, there will be men and women with blue candles up here in the front who would love to talk with you, to answer your questions, and to pray with you. So on the night on which he was betrayed, Jesus took the bread, and after he had given thanks, he broke it, and he said, "This is my body. Do this in remembrance of me." And in the same way, after supper, he took the cup and he said, "This cup is the cup of the new covenant. You now have new access to God through my blood. Drink it in remembrance of me." And Paul says that as often as we eat this bread and drink this cup, we proclaim the Lord's death. We proclaim the gospel until he comes again. He is coming again. Jesus is the host of this meal. This is his table. He invites you to come.